This week, we are celebrating episode number 50 on the Block Reward podcast, and I'm coming back with my second solo episode to share some of my own thoughts and things that I've learned along the way talking to Bitcoiners and being surprised continually by things that I didn't know or hadn't thought of, which is one of the coolest things about Bitcoin. I'm Scott Dietles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how we'll help them. This week's episode is a deep dive into my thoughts around what Bitcoin is, where it's going, and why you want to tune in. Check it out. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward podcast. This week, we're celebrating episode number 50, and I've decided to step back in for a second solo episode to share some reflections on things that I've learned over a year doing podcasts with Bitcoin experts from all over the world, and talk a little bit about my evolving perspective of what I've learned and how it's shaped my own theories and opinions about what is happening with Bitcoin. Maybe just before I get into that, I think it could be worthwhile for me to share my own personal story of how things started with Bitcoin. I read my first Bitcoin book, The Price of Tomorrow by Jeff Booth, in the spring of 2020, during the COVID lockdowns. It was a book that came to me by accident. I figured out early among my peers in my professional life that inflation was a looming problem as the government was creating an unprecedented amount of money to pay everyone to stay home and keep their businesses shut. So I started studying inflation, and after reading a few university economics textbooks, somehow Amazon recommended me Jeff Booth's book. Changed my entire paradigm of what I thought I knew about Bitcoin, which was absolutely nothing. And I spent the rest of that spring reading everything I could. I read The Block Size Wars by Jonathan Beer. I read Sepe Diedemus, The Bitcoin Standard, The Genesis Book, you name it. Anything I could wrap my mind around, and really went on my journey. I started to transition from this concept that Bitcoin was a very real thing, which I think is a really normal entry point for most people when they start to step past the stereotypes that the media have done a great job instilling in the masses. And then from there, you know, Bitcoin is like this. It's like a hole that the closer you get through it, you can see it. It just gets wider and wider on the other end. And so even in the last year, after studying Bitcoin for years, I would say I have understood what is happening on a much deeper level. And number of times throughout the various episodes in the show, I have had aha moments where the guests have said something that profoundly landed with me and just gave me a lot to think about. So some things that I wanted to highlight, I think that, you know, firstly, the global financial system is a very complicated and abstract beast. And we did two episodes in January that I think are worth a review to highlight just one aspect of how convoluted and intertwined some of our financial problems and processes are. And that was episode 15, The Rise of Carry with Kevin Coldiron, and episode 16 with the Peruvian Bull, which we called the Japanese Maginal Line. And really the focus of those two episodes together was to help people with an introductory explanation of a problem that continues to play out today and will for a very long time, which is called the end of the yen carry. And the yen carry is a borrowing and lending matrix where people are borrowing money in Japan, where the interest rates are historically very low, to swap it into a different currency where the interest rate would be higher. And if the interest, if the currency exchanges stay reasonably the same, at some point that carry trade can be closed and the trader takes the profit that was the difference in the interest rates. This thing has been very stable for a very long time because Japan has really done an incredible job controlling their interest rates. But now the Bank of Japan is in a position where they need to try and raise their rates. And as the central banks have, what we tried to explain with those two episodes is how as central banks have shown the market continuously that they will intervene to prop things up or prevent a system meltdown, that invites carry traders to be more and more aggressive in stockpiling these trades. And so the yen carry trade is the one that is, most people would have no idea how the Bank of Japan is affecting things that are happening to them in their local world. And these things are absolutely interconnected because essentially this is one specific bubble that has become so large that unwinding the risk that is accumulated in that trade is going to be incredibly difficult to navigate for just about everybody. Another episode that I wanted to highlight that taught me something was episode 41 that we did with Ivan Makadonsky that we called Addicted to Digits. And it was a really interesting perspective around the idea that most of the wealth in the world is phantom wealth, and people who live in cultures where it is about accumulating more, all we're really doing, whether it's money or followers or likes or whatever, we're just accumulating fictitious numbers. And this is, I think, a very fascinating concept and something that really rang very true for me. We have unintentionally is probably not the right word. It's probably perfectly by design. The digits thing is a distraction, which has essentially fooled everyone into thinking that we're getting more wealthy because the numbers that we associate ourselves with are getting larger, even though that ignores the reality of, when we're talking about purchasing power, the value of the actual numbers themselves is going down. And this is kind of like the fiat money problem in a nutshell, where more and more money means less and less. And that's because the amount of money is continuously changing, which makes it impossible to properly pin a number to what any unit of government money anywhere is worth. And this is a good time, I think, to spend a little bit of time talking about why Bitcoin is different. And this is a question that I get asked all the time, and it is meant to be a Bitcoin for Beginners pod, but we don't necessarily talk about some of these things that are really just very common questions about Bitcoin. Why is Bitcoin different? What makes Bitcoin different? And a few things that I think are worth really clearly sort of spelling out. And firstly, we talked about this with Knut Svanholm very early on in the show. Bitcoin is an agreement on a fixed set of rules. And that one thing is what really makes it different than every other money system in the world, because no other money system in the world has a fixed set of rules, because no government would ever want to have a transparent and fixed set of rules with as it relates to their local currency. Government monies are designed in such a way so that governments have the flexibility to dilute those currencies as they see fit. And they do that at the expense of the wealth of their citizens. And that's not an indictment of the process. That's just a factual assessment of how it works. And so with Bitcoin, participants in the Bitcoin monetary network are able to start thinking about the value of their money in terms of how much they have as a percentage of the total amount available, which is just something that you can really only do with Bitcoin. And that's just one aspect of the unchanging rules. But Bitcoin's fixed supply is a really significant and differentiating factor that makes Bitcoin different than every other fiat currency and also every other crypto. So why Bitcoin and not crypto is an important aspect of this, which I think a lot of people really either struggle with or don't want to believe. Bitcoin is absolutely unique in the digital asset space for a number of reasons. One of them is what's called fair launch. And so when Bitcoin went live, there were no people that were pre-gifted huge piles of Bitcoin, which, in the case of the second largest cryptocurrency, Ethereum, there was a massive presale, and 70% of the Ethereum tokens that will ever exist already existed and were ceded to investors. And so when you have a situation like that, what you have are people that have a financial incentive to sell into the price going up. And this is something that there are also Bitcoiners that have an incentive to sell at certain prices because they've got in early. But those people got in early because they were either lucky or figured it out before other people. And that's kind of a key distinction there. There is no one in charge of Bitcoin. So there was no one in charge to really say like, hey, if you give us $100 million to get this thing off the ground, we're going to give you X number of Bitcoin and this thing's going to work out really well for you. That's not how it went. And that relates to this concept of unchanging rules. So the rules of Bitcoin can be changed, but it happens basis as a result of a consensus of the participants in the network. Whereas in cryptocurrency networks, the rules can be changed by whoever is in charge. This is where cryptocurrency and fiat currencies are the same. Part of the problem is being in a system and in a monetary network where the rules are flexible and can change whenever they might need to change. So the part of the innovation with Bitcoin is the creation of a money system that will not be tinkered with, not at least the core aspects of what Bitcoin is. And that's huge. The other thing I think is really worth reflecting on is network effects. And, you know, so in the crypto space, you have theoretically a never-ending number of competitors that are going to try to compete with Bitcoin for cryptocurrency supremacy. And this is also a very confusing thing for Bitcoin outsiders. You know, it's like some of the innovations that Satoshi solved in the creation of Bitcoin, those are very easy to copy. And so that invites competition. It's a very natural thing for humans to think that the first thing is not going to be the best thing. Typically with everything else, you know, somebody invents the Model T and 100 years later, we've got a self-driving Tesla. In this case, I think that what matters more is the combination of unchanging rules and network effect, where what really matters with a monetary network is the gravity of that network to retain its money. So other cryptos all have these sort of seed round investors that have a financial incentive to sell into the rising price of this thing. And the challenge that any competitor network would have is enticing, building something that would be enticing enough to draw away everyone who's coming in, who's not currently in the Bitcoin network, and also everyone who is already in the Bitcoin network. And this is going to be very difficult because people who are already in Bitcoin understand how valuable the concept of a money system that no one is in control of. So to convince those people that they would want to switch over to a system where someone is in control again is going to be a nearly impossible sell. And it's going to be very difficult for people, new people who are coming in to avoid this understanding eventually. And it's proven itself over the market. So there's something called Bitcoin dominance, which is the percentage of the total digital currency space that is represented by Bitcoin, everything else. And no matter how many, you know, that number goes up and down, but today there are a record number of cryptocurrencies in total. And the Bitcoin dominance number is basically as high as it's ever been. So infinite number of theoretical competitors for Bitcoin. Network effect typically applies to only the one thing, the winner take all. I learned a lot from and continue to learn a lot from my good friend John Ailey, who we had on the show in episode 26. And I think it's worth diving a bit deeper into Bitcoin, the innovation, because it's just such an interesting subject. And this is also helpful in helping people understand what is actually going on with Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is a protocol and the internet is a stack of protocols. And typically in the world of protocols, it is a kind of a winner take all thing. So existing internet protocols, we already have things like HTTP. And my understanding, I'm not an expert on this, but what I've learned is that when a protocol is established, at that point, the development happens on that protocol as opposed to people trying to build other protocols to compete with that thing. And so Bitcoin is best thought of as the native payment protocol of the internet. So when the internet was, as the internet has continued to evolve, and it got to a place, say, in the late 90s, where it was really ready for a mass adoption. There was a lot of things. in the late 90s that the internet still couldn't do. That nobody was thinking about streaming 4K on a handheld device in the late 90s. And in fact, like McDonald's website in the late 90s was just like a landing page. So today, like a huge percentage of their sales come from online. And this is true of like basically every business today is an internet company. But the problem was at that time, there weren't ways to send value over the internet. So the internet is an information network. It is a tool globally to send information anywhere. And that information network is a network of infinite copies. So on your computer, it's effortless to save a picture as many times as you want. And you can send copies of that picture as many times as you want to whoever you want anywhere in the world. The problem with doing that with money is trying to figure out how to have a monetary payment protocol native to the internet that doesn't counterfeit or defraud its users. And this was a very complicated problem that wasn't solved yet when the internet really started to take off. So this is something that was became known as the Byzantine Generals problem. And the Byzantine Generals problem is a game theory, a question about multiple generals trying to lay siege to a city and in a situation where they all need to attack simultaneously. So this is like four generals, each attacking one wall of a square-shaped city. And they all need to attack at the same time for the attack to work. And they have no way to trust each other, and they have no way to communicate simultaneously. So how do you basically achieve consensus in a distributed network? And this was a white paper that was published in the early 80s. And so, you know, ideas with Bitcoin go way back, way earlier than 2009. There were famous people who are currently involved with Bitcoin, like Adam Back, who are working on this problem in the 90s. And it was just a very difficult technical problem to solve. And so Satoshi was able to really combine two things to fix this problem of double spending, which is preventing Bitcoins from being spent more than once, and the Byzantine Generals problem of maintaining a consensus or an agreement around the legitimacy of a distributed ledger that is not centrally managed by any one authority. So blockchains solve this problem of what's called double spend, which is somebody spending Bitcoins more than once, and that has to do with ordering the entry of transactions on a linear ledger. And this is the part that has been copied an infinite number of times in the cryptocurrency world. And why this concept of like Web3 and blockchain, I think, has become a interesting buzzword in the tech space. But proof of work is really the mechanism that enabled this solving of the Byzantine Generals problem. Because the part I didn't mention about that Byzantine Generals problem is that they have no way to trust each other. So we have to assume that this system, for it to work, needs to basically impose a set of rules that just make the cost of cheating so difficult that it makes more sense to cooperate. And proof of work imposes a cost to add information to the blockchain. This is the cost of that is the work that is done by Bitcoin miners. And that work has a cost in the real world, which is electricity. So the miners spend electricity and computing power competing to be the ones to sort of add these blocks to the blockchain. And if they're successful, they are rewarded with new Bitcoin. And it is that mechanism which created a protocol for the internet that has enables the sending of value with avoiding counterfeit and fraud. Now, the cool innovation that came out of that was a money system where the total amount of money in that system is finite. And this is where Bitcoin becomes very abstract for people, but also a very interesting idea is for you know, one of the key ways I think about it is like to avoid counterfeiting in a money system online where you're not interacting with people you would personally meet, is everyone has to know how many beans there are. And that's how we can avoid people having a fraudulent count of money. So a finite money system is in and of itself a step function improvement in terms of money being able to retain its value, because the core problem of why our money cannot retain its value is because they're continuously making more of that money. And that is, again, as I mentioned, that's just a part of the process of how our money system works. So if you're thinking about the long-term future prospects of Bitcoin, they can only continue to make more and more money. And it has to do with things like the yen carry trade. So there's a theoretical never-ending supply of new money to be created that doesn't exist by governments today. And there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. And so in priced in whatever currency you're measuring, as long as Bitcoin continues to do what it's going to do, the ability to own some money that has a fixed supply is a very valuable thing. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in detail, but this idea of a finite money system. And so if you're thinking about cryptocurrencies, and there can be, you know, every cryptocurrency advertises that they have a finite supply too, but when you have individual people in charge of the rules, you can't say that with any degree of certainty that the number is anything, because people, when trusted with the ability to control the supply of a money system, are going to change it when they need to. This is something that's been proven true throughout human history, essentially with every money that's ever existed. So another episode where I really learned a lot was the episode we did with Peter Dunworth, which was number 37, and a concept which he calls triple ledger accounting, which I think is another really important concept for people who are trying to understand Bitcoin to wrap their heads around. And it's this idea that we have been recording transactions as going back to when we first started organizing ourselves into complex civilizations. And from this, money is a technology that was born. And the original way of recording a transaction would have been something that is a single ledger accounting, which is really a receipt. And early history of receipts are things like clay tablets of, you know, three stamps of cows to show that someone had a record of a purchase. And about 500 years ago, we had the innovation of double ledger accounting. And in a double ledger accounting, this is basically the invention of modern banking, where somebody has the responsibility of maintaining a copy of a ledger, which is a running sort of in money coming in and money going out. So on one half of the ledger, you have the customers, and on the other half of the ledger, you have the maintainer of that ledger. And that is a system which enabled all kinds of innovation and global commerce. Banking enabled people to really think about storing wealth in new ways. And is an innovation for prosperity. Triple ledger accounting takes that ledger and turns it into sort of a three-dimensional object that anyone in the world can view. And in a triple ledger accounting system, essentially, we no longer need to have a central authority or a party in the middle that is responsible for maintaining the ledger. This is something that is done by solving this Byzantine General's problem in a distributed way so that anyone can see the ledger. So if anyone can see the ledger at any time, you really don't need to pay someone to run their own ledger. And this is something that is a pretty significant idea. I really strongly recommend that episode. But what it's also doing is inverting sort of a lot of the fundamental principles of how our financial system works today. And so Bitcoin is money that really transforms our concept of money, which is really debt, into credit. So Bitcoin is credit money. Peter was talking about this concept that Bitcoin is the perfect form of collateral. And with Bitcoin, when Bitcoin are mined, from the moment they are created, they are the asset. So there's only 21 million Bitcoin. Each Bitcoin is 1/21 millionth of the entire total supply. And so the Bitcoin itself, it is the collateral. It is the asset. It is the, you know, if you're thinking about Bitcoin as sort of this synthetic, non-physical natural resource, Bitcoin is the thing. And this is not true for paper money. Is really a debt contract where when new money is issued, it's issued against a promise from the government to be paid back over time in the future. And this is how government bonds work. And so new money in the fiat world is really created out of debt with the premise that we're going to create more and more debt. And that continual creation of new money is what also simultaneously causes fiat paper money to become worth less and less over time. So Bitcoin is money where the holder of the Bitcoin is in possession of the asset themselves from the moment they hold it. It's what's called a bearer asset. And because it has this fixed set of rules, it has a known set of properties, which also enable people to have a uniform understanding and assessment of what Bitcoin is. And it's true today to say that there isn't a uniform opinion of what Bitcoin is, but that's mostly because very few people actually understand Bitcoin. And nobody likes to hear that, people who don't understand it, but it's the truth. So I think that what is going on is the price of Bitcoin going from a dollar to 70,000 US or whatever over 15 years is in large part really just a reflection of the growing number of people globally who understand this concept of owning some finite money, why that would be useful. And as that number grows, you have factually more buyers than sellers. The Bitcoin price goes up over time as the number of sellers outpaces the number of buyers. And so that price truly can go up forever. The price of Bitcoin is the one fixed and finite thing in the world. And that thing has also been made to be very easy to buy. So you can buy very small amounts of Bitcoin in most places of the world. It can be purchased. So it's something that's globally accessible. It's a finite thing that's globally accessible. And everyone in the world, to varying degrees, is trying to find a way to outrun the devaluation of their own local money. And so this is something that makes Bitcoin a magnet globally for people. And so the Bitcoin price, the dips get a lot of negative media attention because we live in a car crash society where people are more interested in sensational and bad news as opposed to good. But zooming out under any sort of like longer time frame, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and just objectively look at what the Bitcoin price has done over longer time frames, and we can see that, like, objectively, there are a lot more buyers of Bitcoin than sellers. So this leads me to kind of two episodes that I want to highlight, which was Larry Lepard, one of my favorite Bitcoiners, episode 12, and Hafa Zaguri, who was episode 29. And what does this mean when you have a globally available asset that has fixed and discernible properties and is, you know, desirable and accessible all over the world? And there's something called Gresham's Law, which is an idea that when there are two forms of money in a market over time, and one is better than the other over time, people will understand this on their own and they will prefer to hold the desirable form of money and get rid of the less desirable form of money. And Bitcoin is this really interesting thing because it is spendable internet money, but it is also property. And it is a form of property that has some very desirable characteristics on its own. And so I think that the Gresham's Law concept for Bitcoin applies both to money and property. And so I think when we're trying to assess what Bitcoin could be in the future, this is where it's just so much of what we do has evolved into these ultra complex processes without us really stopping to think about how absurd a lot of the stuff that we do to protect the wealth we've accumulated really is. So Hoppe was talking about Frankenstein asset classes. And really, you know, so if we're thinking about the world, Bitcoin today is worth about $1 trillion US. Gold, somewhere around 15 or 16 trillion. Art is like 18 trillion. Equities, 115 trillion. Real estate, 330 trillion. The bond market, 300 trillion. Money itself is 120 trillion. So all of these big asset classes are like hundreds of times bigger than Bitcoin. And there's, on top of that, like, you know, derivatives and other financial instruments, which sort of take the total global asset value probably into the quadrillions if we had a way to properly measure it. And so Bitcoin as a money is, can be traded very simply as people play out Gresham's law and start thinking about the benefit of storing their money in a money that is finite as opposed to any other form of money that is infinite. That's actually a pretty simple trade when you rationally wrap your mind around the difference of what you're trying to do. If you're starting to think about things like equities, part of the problem or the confusion that even savvy investors have is parsing the difference between CPI, consumer price index, and currency debasement, monetary inflation. So what we are told on TV is that CPI is a measure of affordability and living. And what it really is an arbitrary basket of the price of goods measured over time to see, you know, kind of give like a thumbnail of how the price of things are going up. But what is included in that basket is changed all the time and is strongly manipulated to produce an outcome that disassociates the impression of what CPI is versus the reality of debasement. And how we can measure this, and Michael Saylor is great for this, is looking at the performance of major asset classes versus the expansion of the money supply instead of CPI. So in Canada, the money supply tends to expand between 8 and 9%. In the US, it's around 7%. So if you think about a stock index like the S&P 500 returning something around 7% per year, if you're measuring it against monetary inflation, it's really just staying level. And this is also true with real estate. The average price of a condo over the last 30 years in Toronto compared to the expansion of the Canadian money supply, the two charts virtually look identical. So the challenge is what people are really trying to do with investing is outrun inflation. We all understand that we need to grow our money into the future so that we can retain the purchasing power we have now, or hopefully do even better, enrich ourselves. But when we view the performance of most of the major options you have against monetary debasement instead of CPI, what we find is that very few people actually win. And that's not taking into account things like, you know, taxes on dividends. If you're into property, you're going to have different types of property taxes and tax on the rental income that you're getting. So there are a number of different aspects of the financial game that if you are even lucky enough to outperform the debasement of the currency you're using where you live, you're probably unlikely in a real terms to beat inflation. And so what we have is this idea of a monetary singularity. And this is really what I think is going on, because when you think about real estate strategies or stock portfolios, people who hold art or gold, what people are really trying to do is find the thing that is better at going up in price than all the other things. And asset classes grow in relation to each other, depending on how easy it is to understand why that thing is the thing that goes up and how hard it is to participate in that thing. So Bitcoin is, during its lifespan, the best performing asset of all time by just about every measure. I think 3 out of every 4 years since it's existed, it's been the best performing asset of that year. And generally, the counter theories of why Bitcoin won't work just operate on this assumption that it can't continue to be the thing that's the best thing at going up. But this is where Bitcoin is so beautiful, because it is really engineered to go up forever because of these fixed principles, which anyone can assess on their own, and this triple ledger, which anyone can view. So if you're just looking for the thing that is going to go up better than other things, the fact that it's intangible physically is a massive benefit, because in the case of gold, physical gold is difficult to store and transport at scale. And in the case of art, you can't buy 1/100th of a Rembrandt. So that's just not a very accessible thing for most people. Real estate is, I think, the ultimate Frankenstein asset, because it's physically tangible and it is fairly easy to understand. And this is why we have really seen what I call the hyper-financialization of real estate, where people have turned, and this is especially true where I live in Canada, people have turned houses into bank accounts. Houses are people's primary retirement plan. And this is causing things, a sort of a cognitive dissonance, where as more people employ the strategy, the price of the assets go up, and the banking system is engineered to help people on their journey of going further and further into debt to participate in this Ponzi scheme, which the more help people get borrowing money, and this could be longer mortgage terms or, you know, looser borrowing rules, is that enables the price of these assets to rise. And so this is just something people are, I think, in large part unintentionally doing to outrun inflation. And people are, you know, ingenious. You're going to find all kinds of solutions to the problem of money becoming less valuable over time. With real estate, you know, this is one of the most illiquid things. Houses are take a long time to sell. Your market of buyers is limited to the people who might be interested in the geographical region you're in. There are all kinds of local risks with the government who oversees the jurisdiction of that real estate. There are just an infinite number. And that doesn't even take into account like the maintenance and upkeep of the physical property itself. So Bitcoin, if you think about all those different asset classes, oh, and equities. So equities, you know, these are a collection of companies where you're betting on the success of companies or the market's perception of the success of companies. So in each of these kind of like major categories, you know, there's a great argument to say, really, Bitcoin is a thing which delivers a simpler solution for buying something that will have a chance to continue to go up faster than the other things. So if all you have to do is buy Bitcoin, and then you don't need to buy a house and deal with renters and replace the kitchen every 8 years and deal with escalating property taxes, you know, this is, in its own way, it's just as easy of a choice to make as swapping out your infinite money for finite money. It's just that these are ideas that are uncomfortable for people, and, you know, new ideas take time to take hold. But again, Bitcoin is hundreds of times smaller than any one of these individual things. The bond market is an especially interesting one. We go all the way back to episode 2 with Greg Foss, talk about the size of borrowed money that is issued from debt. So there's hundreds of trillions of debt contracts issued in paper money, where Peter Dunworth explained in episode 37 that if you have Bitcoin, you have money that can't be diluted to operate this system of debt contracts. So Bitcoin is a better form of collateral than paper money and the promise of more paper money. And so the entire concept of how we think about borrowing and collateralizing changes when there is an asset available in the market that can be viewed without the need for an institution in the middle to verify that it exists, and everyone understands exactly how much of it there is. So this thing is property. It is collateral. It is a better form of money. And for all of those reasons, and it's tiny. So for these reasons, it has a massive opportunity to continue to be the best performing asset. And so as it does that, Bitcoin becomes a positive feedback loop for disproving naysayers. And the more it goes up, the more it goes up. And again, there is an infinite number of paper money ready to be traded for finite money. So as long as paper money is being printed, people will need to employ some kind of strategy to outrun the devaluation of that paper money. And there will be the same number of Bitcoin in 20 years that there are today. There will probably actually be much less because some Bitcoin is being lost by new people or, you know, lost wallets, things all the time. So the amount of available Bitcoin is probably going to reduce. And everybody today is facing this problem of the dissolving value of money. And I think that we're starting to see other asset classes really start to crack under the weight of all of the leverage that has built up under people trying to find a place to keep money safe. And in commercial real estate, you can really see it in the US. There was a story from a few weeks ago about a triple A rated high rise in downtown New York that sold for $330 million in 2006 and sold for $13 million last week. So when things are, you know, the problem with other asset classes, and this is very true of residential real estate, and part of the reason I love this topic so much is because I really want people to stop and think about the realisticness of what is going on. If you're leveraging yourself to the hilt to go all in to get a home, thinking this is your last best chance to get a home, if houses continue to inflate at the prices that they have been for another 20 years, like they have over the last 20, in another 20 years, there's going to be nobody who can afford a house. So this system, as it's being constructed, based on infinite money creation and sort of the infinite expansion of debt, is it's not only unsustainable, but it's really the perfect system to be blown up by one thing that cannot expand. So I spent a lot of the year asking different people that question, what is Bitcoin? And I've never actually answered it myself. And I think that this is how I kind of want to wrap up the episode. So what is Bitcoin? It is a technology for streaming money on the internet. And it's a protocol. And protocols are typically a winner-take-all situation. So as we think about network effect, there's a reason why there's only one Facebook. And even people who might have had ideas about how to do a better version of Facebook. Once everybody is on a certain network, there isn't much point in trying to reinvent that thing. And this is especially true with monetary networks because of the importance of the network having a gravity for it retaining that monetary value. When you're thinking about a money system, you need to have more buyers than sellers. And that is intimately connected to network effect. So if you're thinking about Bitcoin and some other cryptocurrency, if Bitcoin, unless that thing can convince enough people that it's going to be the thing that is better at going up than Bitcoin, then as new units of that thing are issued, people are likely to sell those units and buy the thing that is going to be, has been proven to go up more. And so this is why no matter how many cryptocurrencies there are over time, Bitcoin as a percentage of the total market available really has looked very good. So it's a protocol and it's a technology for streaming money on the internet. It's a step function improvement in money. Money is a technology that we invented to solve a problem called the coincidence of wants. And this is the idea that in a simple economy, if I have turnips and you have milk and I happen to want milk and you happen to want turnips, we're fine. But as soon as we start getting into more complicated economies where we need more exchange of goods. You might not have the thing I want. I might not even know someone who has the thing that you want. So we need something in the middle that can facilitate the exchange. That thing needs to be valuable. And ideally, that thing will retain its value. And so different forms of money have succeeded and failed because of various limitations. And one of these examples, our longest running successful form of money is gold. And even other assets like the ones I mentioned, real estate priced in gold, the charts look very different compared to being priced in dollars. So gold has done a great job holding its value over time. However, gold has these physical limitations, which have prevented it from becoming a global money in an information age. And so Bitcoin has really taken the desirable characteristics of money and transformed them into a digital money that is native to the internet. And what that's doing is, I think, creating what I call the investment singularity, which is Bitcoin is the best thing at going up. And we all, every person alive, every business, every pension, every government needs the thing that is the best thing that is going up. And so the longer it continues to be that thing, the more people will eventually have to look at it and sort of capitulate to the idea that other people figured this out earlier than they did, which is one of the biggest barriers to Bitcoin. But we've already seen what I would consider to be the start of the investment singularity as looking at stocks in the S&P that have performed. So basically, I talked earlier about the idea that the S&P 500 is essentially just a savings account for staying zero if you're measuring real rate of return as a measurement of the performance versus monetary debasement instead of CPI. But that number, the S&P 500, over the last while was really consolidated down into these Magnificent Seven tech stocks. And from there, it's been even further consolidated down basically to NVIDIA. The market is chasing the thing that is the best thing for going up. It's like the holy grail of outrunning currency debasement. And the challenge is that currency debasement is accelerating because compounding applies to the money you owe as well as your investments. So the more money our governments borrow, the more money they have to create to just keep the lights on. And this is a problem that is nonlinear. It is an exponentially compounding issue. And in the US, it took like 200 years for the US to accumulate $100 trillion worth of debt. And today, it's about 100 days. Every 100 days, a new $1 trillion of debt is being thrown onto the pile. So the value of the unit of currency that you're using is intimately tied to the total number of units of that currency. The more they make, the less each one individually is worth. So this is really, Bitcoin is an idea whose time has come. It is a form of money available to everyone who uses the internet that has a fixed set of rules and a finite supply. And because of that, it is the most desirable type of asset. And on top of that, it, by virtue of what it is something that imbues property rights to every person alive. Every person who owns some Bitcoin has property, which is very difficult to confiscate and because it's non-physical. So this is also a key innovation. This is a tool to provide humanity with an escape hatch from the involuntary dilution of money, which is a confiscation of wealth from all of us, and a form of property, which is borderless and very difficult to take away from someone. So Bitcoin is this thing that has immensely desirable characteristics, which are becoming more and more valuable as the problem of money printing is becoming better and better understood. And even people who don't understand Bitcoin do understand the problem of money printing. I bought a watermelon the other day in the grocery store for $37. So this is something that is not going to go away. And I found Bitcoin in 2020 because I was worried about what money printing was going to mean for inflation. And it's an impossible aspect of life that is just no one can ignore it now. So I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I would encourage you to watch these episodes that I've mentioned and a bunch of the others, all the ones I didn't mention. What we're trying to do with the show is talk about Bitcoin in a way that avoids the ultra technical stuff, so that, you know, it's something that takes a long time to understand, and nobody is going to really get Bitcoin after an hour or probably even 100 hours. But what I try to do with the show and what I hope is different about it is it's just people who know quite a bit about Bitcoin talking about it in a way that is meant to be sort of like a very conversational and inclusive dive into different niche topics of, you know, that relate to people's personal passions that are understood through Bitcoin. So it does matter to me that you tune in, and I want to thank you for following the show. And please like and subscribe and send me any feedback, comments. This is a really important idea, and I'm trying to do what I can to help as many people as possible understand it. So thank you again for tuning in. I hope to see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits, supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.